Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Mythgard Academy. This is session number 21 of Till We Have Faces, and this evening we are going to get Orawal in front of the courtroom. She's going to have her day in court today. We were looking at the last two of her kind of tribulations. Two and a half, in a sense, if we count the one where she hobbles down to the river. That wasn't exactly a tribulation, but anyway, that first incident where she was intending to drown herself. And then, of course, we had the dream, perhaps, though again, lots of uncertainty about that. The dream of when she was an ant and had to, sort things and carry huge grains much larger than herself. And then we discussed last time her vision, which she walked into with eyes open. Both of these last two visions, this happened, of the golden rams and the flock of wool that she attempted to get but couldn't. And then, of course, we had her at the very end last time walking across the open desert and then seeing the eagle. So those are the that completes sort of the set of trials and tribulations, or in this case, tribulations and then trial, as that's what we're going to be segueing to this evening. So just a really quick note, though, before we begin. For those of you who haven't heard, I'm sure many of you have heard this. It's the big exciting news in Tolkien studies this week. And as you can understand, particularly exciting and dear to my own heart, is that it has finally been officially announced that a Poetic Works of J.R.R. Tolkien is being published, edited by Hammond and Scull, due for release this September. This September, at least in the UK, though there's not been a very big divide in recent years, when there have been new Tolkien things published, there's not been a big divide between American and UK publication, though I haven't heard much about the American yet. Anyway, it's going to be a lot. It is like 200 poems, as Jackie says. And it the whole volume is supposed to be about like 1,500 pages long. So it's going to be like a three-volume, 1,500-page set of the poetic works of J.R.R. Tolkien. I think it's going to be it's going to be a lot of fun. What am I going to do with this? I don't know. This is the Tolkien publication I've been waiting for years. I've been delighted to see the other things come out, the Numenor stuff, the Gondolin stuff, the Beren and Lúthien stuff, but none of that was new. It was good to see it come out because it made those things easier to read and more accessible for many people. But that wasn't really exciting. This is exciting because there are going to be, among those hundreds of poems published, dozens, possibly scores of poems that have never really appeared anywhere. And some that have never been published anywhere. And some of them, which have been published, have only been published in, like, parish journals and things like that, which most people haven't read. So, exactly. They say 60 unpublished, though Jackie, I'm not 100% sure how they're defining unpublished. Like, I suspect, knowing Hammond and Scull a little bit, I suspect that they would not use the word unpublished to describe a poem that Tolkien published in like a minor journal, which has not been available in circulation for, you know, decades. I doubt they would call that unpublished because it's technically published, but unpublished as far as the Tolkien public is concerned, essentially inaccessible to like almost everybody. I have to say, yes, there will be multiple versions of some poems, Bricktales, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that they've talked about already is that some of the things that they're looking at, some of the poems that they're publishing are earlier versions. Like, there have been many times when, you know, Tolkien had a poem which he was working on and which went through like very different, like big changes, not only in like its like lines and wording, but in its like whole concept, right? And which versions of it have been published in History of Middle Earth by Christopher, but sometimes only like the ones at the tail end or whatever. And so we don't even know the things that came before. Yeah, Errantry is a good example of a poem which went through massive changes. Of course, there are lots of examples. In fact, like I would say actually the majority of the poems in The Adventures of Tom Bombadil fit that description, actually. But in any case, so I see people talking about Maureen was saying she hopes there's an audiobook, and needless to say, I think there should be an audiobook for everything. I in my opinion, a book isn't published until an audiobook is published. Like it's just, you know, being privately circulated until it's published in audiobook form, as far as I'm concerned. But I have to admit that I'm not excited. That's one book. I will listen to, there isn't, you know, sometimes people will be like, well, this is a book that does not really lend itself well to an audiobook, to which I say nonsense. There isn't any book that doesn't lend itself well to audiobooks, with the possible exception of the poetic works of J.R.R. Tolkien. And I say this because I have never heard. Actors are horrible at reading poetry. I'm just going to say it. Actors are horrible at reading poetry. Even wonderful actors who are wonderful audiobook readers, like Derek Jacobi. Derek Jacobi's a marvelous reader. I love Derek Jacobi's readings, right? You know, whether it, like, he, you know, all the, what he's done, like his Smith of Wooton Major and his Farmer Giles of Ham and his, like, he, I, you know, I love his Voyage of the Dawn Treader in the Narnia series. Like, he's a great, great audiobook reader. His Adventures of Tom Bombadil, unlistenable. I can't even. I will never listen to it a second time. It's a horrible sense of rhythm. Like, they just don't. They're not trained with an ear to poetry. They're trained to, like, make dialogue sound natural, right? That's what they're good readers, because, you know, good, like, readers of novels and things, because they are often really good narrators. Andy Serkis is not a good narrator. He's a good voice actor. He does dialogue well. He's a poor narrator. That's his problem. But some are very good, readers. But for, like, they try to do the same thing with the poetry and they just wreck it. Oh man, it's horrible. So we will see. I kind of doubt they're going to be in a rush. HarperCollins, that is going to be in a rush to do an audiobook version of it. So we'll see. Oh, you know, I'm not saying there are no good readings of poetry. It's very possible that they'll find it. It's just, it's rare. It's very, very rare. Yeah. So we'll see. Anyhow, so I will say I'm less focused on the audiobook version of the poetic works than I will be of any other work that is released, frankly. So Meow, I have not heard Judi Dench read poetry. I'd have to listen to it. And if I did, I would not be afraid to say to her, if she does not have an ear for the meter of poetry, like then I'd tell her, I'd be patient. I'd try to be patient and kind. But it's hard. It's a very different skill than doing dialogue, you know, than doing the thing that most actors are trained to do. This is why, I mean, I don't know, I've got on this rant many times before. This is why so many actors mess up Shakespeare. Because Shakespeare, like, you're supposed to be able to hear the poetry in Shakespeare. And there are so many of Shakespeare's poetic jokes that they don't get. that don't come across on the modern stage because modern actors don't get verse. They don't understand it. They don't feel it. They don't hear it. They just try to make all of Shakespeare sound like it's just conversation. And it is conversation, but it's not just conversation. Anyway, so we will see. Jocelyn, that's where I disagree. Works with lots of footnotes. Charts are harder, but I would prefer an audiobook form of The Nature of Middle Earth with all of its tables and everything every day of the week, right? Every day of the week. It's not hard to do. And by the way, I think that the relatively recent audiobook release of Unfinished Tales is brilliant. Like, so well done. And the way they did that, to do that in, for all of the history of Middle Earth, no reason not to do it. No reason at all not to do it. It'd be very, very readable in that form. Unfinished Tales. Did I misspeak? No. Unfinished Tales. It's really good. It's really good. Exactly, yeah. The way they did, as Keller Ross says, so they had an old actor and a young actor. So they had two different voices. And they had the young actor reading the stuff that J.R.R. Tolkien read. And then they had the older actor reading Christopher's notes, which I found that delightful. And the two actors were father and son, yeah. So they had the son reading Tolkien's part and the father reading Christopher's part. And the reversal of that I found entirely delightful, because of course there was something in there was this sense of irony, right, in listening to that, but the irony was quite fitting because it's very true to the reality, right? That is, to have, like, you know, the older Christopher commenting on the work of his father that his father wrote when he was young, right? Totally works, right? It totally works. So well done. I would listen to that pair read the whole history of Middle Earth in a heartbeat. Like, they would do a great job and it would be fantastic. I'm digressing now. I did want to make sure that I just mentioned the reason, of course, I specifically wanted to mention the poetic works is that it has some kind of implications here. I think obviously I want to work my way through the poetic works of J.R.R. Tolkien, but I'm not quite sure how, like, in what context, in what format to do that. Obviously, 1,500 pages of Tolkien's poetry would be like, you know, let's elect one book to do for the next 15 years, you know, of Mythgard Academy, which doesn't seem quite the right approach. But anyway, we'll... Yeah, Maureen, as you say, once it's published, it might become clearer. I think maybe what we can... I mean, because obviously we're coming towards the end of the history of Middle-earth anyway. So if we... if we finish, you know, we do the War of the Jewels. We did the War of the Jewels. We do the Peoples of Middle-earth. And then we, you know, maybe we split it up. And, you know, when we're... Because we never totally had decided what we would do when we were done with the history of Middle-earth. So if we kind of divide it up, I don't know, maybe we can continue like we did with the History of Middle-earth series, doing a section of the poetry at a time, and then interspersing it with some other books so that we don't just talk about that nonstop for a while. That's one possibility. I will say, Jackie, that the sort of the time standard of the time I spend in exploring the Lord of the Rings on the poetry there. It's a little bit different than what I would do. I'm not going to be doing the same kind of like I wouldn't do if we were going through the poetic works. I wouldn't be doing, you know, this kind of like multi-layer, you know, prosody analysis of every line of every poem in the whole book, especially since undoubtedly many of the poems in the book are long and are going to be like, you know, longer drafts of long poems. And you know, I wouldn't be doing a line by line metrical analysis, you know, of like every line of an epic poem or something. So it would be a little bit different, but there would be some where I would certainly want to be doing that. Anyway, we'll see. Jocelyn doesn't believe me, and that's perfectly fair. Just wanted to bring it up. Something for us to think about as we're moving forward. We'll come back and discuss this again later on, of course. But we'll see. Anyway, it's not coming out until September, so we've got a little time. I suspect. Well, I think it's possible that we'll be getting into, or at least towards, the peoples of Middle-earth by then. But anyway, let's get back to Till We Have Faces as we are coming down towards the end here. So let's do a quick reminder where we were. The divine bird came down. We'll just reread this so that we can remember the transition, because these transitions, especially in when she's, and she is now from here to the end of the book, is basically going to be, she's not going to emerge exactly from, we're not going to see her emerge from this vision. The transitions, which are sort of dreamlike transitions, are nevertheless, I think, fairly important, right? The sequence and the transitioning. So let's remember where we were here in the third tribulation. I sat upon the sand, gazing up at them, that is, gazing up at the snakes and scorpions and unchancy creatures that cover the slopes of the mountain that she is supposed to scale in order to get in order to get to the source of the river that runs from the death, from the deadlands, in order to get the waters of death and carry them out to Unget, to deliver them to Unget without spilling a drop. Remember, that's the terms of the, and so she's carrying an empty bowl across the desert. I sat upon the sand, gazing up at them, till I felt as if the flesh would be burned off my bones. Then at last there came a shadow. Oh, mercy of the gods! Could it be a cloud? I looked up at the sky and was nearly blinded, for the sun was still straight above my head. I had come, it seemed, into that country where the day never passes. Yet at last, though the terrible light seemed to bore through my eyeballs into my brain, I saw something, black against the blue, but far too small for a cloud. Then by its circlings I knew it to be a bird. Then it wheeled and came lower, and at last was plainly an eagle, but an eagle from the gods, far greater than those of the highlands and fars. It lighted on the sand and looked at me. Its face was a little like the old priest's, but it was not he. It was a divine creature. Okay, so the quick sort of reminders here. The thing that I keep, and I just, the more, just going back to this again, I'm reminded even more powerfully. Remember we were talking about the transition, I guess, between the mortal and the divine world, the boundaries and the frontiers that we've been on that boundary a number of times, having those encounters between the divine and the mortal. And remember Orawal's complaints that the gods always hid themselves and concealed themselves. Why don't they speak clearly? Why don't they just show up? Why don't they just stand right in front of us and tell us what they mean? Why can't we just deal with them openly? Why won't they deal with us openly? Why can't we deal with them openly? Right? Why does it all have to be? Why are holy places dark places? Why should that be? Why are the teachings in mysteries and sacred stories and symbolic rituals? Why all of that nonsense, right? Why can't we just look at the gods face to face? Why can't we just have this out? And I think that one of the things that we are seeing here is a partial answer to that question. Remember the trajectory of her tribulations, right? First, she went an old woman to try to end her life. She was focused on the oldness and weakness and infirmity of her body. And then she went down to the river to attempt to drown herself and end her life. She did not trust herself, remember, to walk in to the ankle, to the belly, to the neck, and to keep walking and seek and find death that way. So she was going to try to throw herself in, right? But it was all about that river as the boundary there between life and death. Then, of course, in her second trial, her second trial was all about things which seemed very much parallel to, like, her human world things. We were looking at this, several of you were making this connection last time, when we were looking at her emphasis on her sitting in judgment, right, and how she is trying to sift and sort truth from lies and justice from injustice, right, and to make just decrees and sort out these petty matters that she didn't actually really care about, who stole the cheeses and whatnot. And so her first tribulation, her first vision tribulation about being an aunt, you may recall, seemed to be a kind of extension or manifestation, a kind of a symbolic representation of that connected with the work that she did. And the pain of that, we've seen it several times, the kind of physical pains and mental pains that she has caused herself by her, all of the work, the long hours that she keeps and how she drives herself to work in the pillar room, which is the place of her ruling and her physical work. Leaf, I agree. Who stole the cheeses? Sounds like a children's book. Yeah, I agree. I agree. So as I say, the first tribulation, in that sense, it seemed to be, you know, she was turned back from the river, right? She made that first attempt, whether it was in a dream or vision or whether it really happened, she doesn't know. She made that first attempt to cross over the boundary between life and death. And the frontier between life and death and the frontier between the human and the divine, it doesn't seem to be, those don't seem to be identical things, but there's clearly a relationship between those two things, right? Okay. She's turned back from that, has that first vision of what seems to be in some ways connected with her mortal life and her mortal work, right? Then in the second vision, in the second tribulation, that was when she crosses the river, exactly like with the language that clearly reminds us of her attempt to throw herself in the river and her not trusting herself to walk into it. And that's, of course, what she does in the second vision. In the second vision, she starts off on the mortal side and she sees the gorgeous divine side, which looks like the Valley of the Gods up on top of the mountain, right? And on the other side of the river, you know, the river of the gods up there that Psyche helped her cross. Then she crosses the river like the river of death and goes into the realm of the gods, and in their joy and love for her, I mean, they're the rams of the gods are real enthusiastic about coming to get to know her, right? And they trample right over her and run over her. So it's a lot. When she does make that transition, she finds that she can't cope with it. Not because the gods are angry at her, not because the divine is hostile against her, but because it is so much her mortal body, her mortal self can't cope with it. It's just impossible. And then in this third tribulation, she's out in the desert under the glaring sun. And she is journeying into the Deadlands. She is on this holy quest. She's clearly not in mortal lands anymore at all. So again, thinking of the trajectory of the hole in her third vision, you know, so the The first one was about trying to cross into death and into the divine realm and getting rebuffed. The second one seemed to be mostly mortal realm based. The second one was about crossing over. And the third one seems to me to be mostly on the other side, right? Dealing with these spiritual things, with this, she's in this other world place, this other world desert where she's going to climb this other world mountain in order to go down into the deadlands explicitly, in order to get the water of death in her bowl. This is not a mortal world kind of place. And when she is in this mortal, this divine world place, she finds the glare of the, it's wide open here. There is nowhere to hide. There is no shade. There is no shadow. There is nowhere you can get away from the sun that is still straight above her head. Time doesn't pass. Remember how she talked about that's like the one mercy, right? When like the days are torturous and unendurable, they feel unendurable. But of course, humans have great capacity to endure things, in fact. That is to suffer without dying from it. But she said like the one mercy is that at least the days pass. Unless there be a place in the Deadlands where that doesn't happen, and here she is, right? Again, another reason why I think that we're supposed to understand that this is the divine world that she's in, right? And that I think that her experience here is a reflection of her own attitude. I think that a lot of what we see in this description right here on this slide is essentially an answer to her question. Why do the gods deal in these shadowy ways? Why can't they just be open with us? Answer, because this is what it would be like if they were. Remember the rams? Remember what happened when you had an uninhibited encounter with the rams of the gods? Right? They completely plowed you over. Because, not because they were angry, not because they were violent, but because they were a lot, right? They were like a great cataract, right? And there are no shadows here. What she wants more than anything else is shade, is shadow, something to break up the glare of the light shining on her. Yeah, a veil. Boy, wouldn't that be nice, Jackie, right about now. Yeah, yeah. Something to ward off the light of the sun. What are holy places again? Holy places are dark places. Maybe. Yeah, Mrs. Manrick, you're right. Oh, mercy of the gods. Could it be a cloud? So you're saying that darkness would be a mercy, that maybe if in a holy place, if a holy place is a place where the human and the mortal come together, where they interface with each other, maybe those places are dark places out of the mercy of the gods. Perhaps it is the mercy of the gods that has led those places to be dark. Because this, to me, sounds like her getting what she asked for. Openness. Remember Psyche's experience of feeling her mortality, of being aware of her mortality when she came into the presence of the gods. Right, of this, even just of the lesser spirits in the house of the god, much less the god himself. And again, is it perhaps an act of mercy that Psyche's husband says, you can only see me in the darkness right now? Because if he were revealed completely to her, if his presence were reeled. Again, what happens in Greek mythology when that happens? What does Anchises think is going to happen to him, right? When he discovers that it was Aphrodite, that it was Venus that he was lying with, right? What does happen to, what's her name? Semele, right? One of Zeus's mistresses, the one whom he reveals himself to in his full glory, right? And that's what's happening. You know, it's a slower bake here, right? But I think that's what is happening here. To Orawal. This is her getting essentially what she asked for. So now, mightn't it be nice, Orawal, to go into a nice, dark, shady house of Unget, right? And to meet the gods there instead of meeting the gods like this. So, anyway, okay. Because this is also the transition into the courtroom scene. So and we talked about last time the connection between the divine bird and the old priest. But now let's go on. Let's go on with the bird. "Woman," it said, "who are you?" "Orawal, queen of Gloam," said I. "Then it is not you that I was sent to help. What is that roll you carry in your hands?" I saw now, with great dismay, that what I had been carrying all this time was not a bowl, but a book. This ruined everything. So remember, it's a roll. Her book is a scroll. It's not a codex, right? So it doesn't have pages. It unrolls and rolls, right? So roll, book, same thing. But remember, she was supposed to be carrying an empty bowl. Her job, the task that she was set by Unget, right, was to take the empty bowl into the mountain, get the waters of death, and carry them out back to Unget without spilling a drop, right? That was the trial that she was supposed to do. And so she needs the bowl. She's supposed to be carrying an empty bowl because it is the empty bowl that is going to enable her to complete her task. The bowl is supposed to be filled with the waters of death. But it turns out that what had been an empty bowl, or what she thought was an empty bowl, turns out to be a book. And this ruined everything because now she can't complete the task, can she? And yes, Jackrabbit, I agree. The way the transitions happen in this part of the book, and it's one of the things that make the end of this book confusing and a little hard to follow, is the very verisimilitude with which C.S. Lewis, sort of conveys this dream experience, right? It's very dreamlike to believe that you're carrying a thing and then you look down and it turns out it was like it has changed into something else. And not only did you not know when it changed, but you know it. She knows exactly what it is, as Jackrabbit points out. It is my complaint against the gods, right? And of course, the way that he describes these kinds of transitions can be a little bit bewildering, like dreams often are bewildering. And he creates that experience in us as we read it through. And I think that that's very effective and it's very important because the fact that we are kind of being carried along with Orawal here is one of the things, it parallels Orawal with us. And I think that that's an important element. I think that's an important thing. Yeah. Anyway, it is my complaint against the gods. So what she's carrying is book one, right? Her old book that she wrote. Not book two, because book two is the account of all of this. All of these things that happened to her and the things that she came to understand after she wrote her book. Which ended, remember how it ended? What are the final words? This is always important to remember. What are the final words of her her last book of book one? Yes, they have no answer. The gods have no answer for her complaint. Right? Yes. Okay. So that's what she has. She has book one in her hands. It is my complaint against the gods. So we don't know what to do with it yet, necessarily, but we must remember that her book, book one, is being interchanged with the empty bowl with which she was supposed to take up the waters of death. Okay? It's okay that we don't know what to do with that yet. We will, I hope, later on. That's just we just need to register that really sort of hard here. And notice how the third tribulation here, this quest to get the waters of death and bring them back to Ungit, is turning into her trial. Her trial doesn't come after that. Her trial is not, there's not a clean separation between those two things at all. They get merged together, and the merging begins with the substitution of the bowl and the book. Right? But her first reaction is, this ruined everything. I'm not going to be able to complete the quest. The eagle clapped his wings and lifted his head and cried out with a loud voice, "She's come at last! Here is the woman who has a complaint against the gods!" Immediately, 100 echoes roared from the face of the mountains. "Here is the woman! A complaint against the gods! Plaint against the gods!" Remember how she said at the beginning of book one that she was going to do a thing that perhaps no one has ever done before. And that is, she is going to make her complaint against the gods. She is going to speak truth to power. She is going to say openly the charges that she has to make against the gods. Like, and she wonders, there are several times, she anticipates how the gods might respond to that, right? They might strike her down. She several times almost dares them to do it, right? Even again from page one, she was like, "I'm old and have almost nothing left to live for anyway, so whatever. I've lost everything that I love, so do your worst, gods," right? "You're probably going to smite me in retribution because of me daring to do this thing. Do your worst," right? So she assumes that in horror at her temerity and blasphemy of complaining against the gods, they're going to strike her down. And remember, there are several other times in the narrative when she's anticipating that too. When she's coming down off the mountain after the appearance of the god of the mountain and the curse of Psyche and the god speaking to her, she's expecting, like, which is the cliff I'm going to get suddenly swept off of? Remember all that kind of thing? So there are lots of places where she's sort of anticipating, how are they going to respond? And when we get there, we see, Devorah, just as you say, she is expected. Devorah says, "This is always such a surprise to me every time, that she is expected, anticipated even." Yes. Yes, because her whole tone, her whole attitude, her entire, all of her presuppositions have led her to think that whatever might happen, it wasn't going to be this, right? Maybe it would be smiting her in wrath. Maybe it would be ignoring her. That was what she was accusing the gods of at the end of her book, right? "You're probably going to say nothing at all. If you strike me down, you'll prove that I'm right. If you say nothing at all, then it's because you have no answer. Right? Either way, I win. And you've proven me correct." And instead, yeah, Jack Revit, that's exactly it. It's like she's a celebrity in the Deadlands. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Hapuna Girl, welcome. Hapuna Girl says, the echoing feels unsubstantial and minimizing. Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? On the one hand, there's 100 echoes roaring from the face of the mountain, and it gives the sense of there's this whole crowd of, like, everyone. The land itself has been anticipating her coming. She's come at last. Here is the woman who has a complaint against the gods. They've been waiting for this. But yes, the echoes. On the one hand, again, you get that feeling. There's a feeling of a crowd. There's a feeling of as I said, even the land itself anticipating her. And yet also, it is kind of impersonal. And how did you say it, Hapuna? Unsubstantial and minimizing. Yeah, yeah, I agree. I agree. And yeah, Devorah was pointing out that the echoes change a complaint against the gods to plaint against the gods. And that is an interesting... So on the one hand, there's kind of a play, wordplay there a little bit that Lewis is doing. The word plaint was a fairly common word in more archaic language. It comes from French, Old French, and even Latin, as Lewis would be the first one to tell you. One of the most influential works of the Middle Ages, of the High Middle Ages, was a work called De Plaintu Natura, which is the complaint of nature, the plaint of nature. And the word plaintiff comes from that same place. Yeah, exactly. And it is true that a plaint in English usage can be used more to a lament, right? And that's where I think that sort of the play is. On the one hand, so the word play is plaint. On the one hand, plaint and complaint are synonyms. Technically, they're synonyms. Plaint is the older form. The de plaintu natura, the plaint of nature, is nature complaining. She's making a complaint. She's presenting a complaint in that the allegorical figure of nature. But yes, the word plaint in more modern English has an increasing association with sadness and lamentation. Yes, Sharon and Jackrabbit are both talking about the word plaintive or plaintively, right? You think about what that has come to mean. It shifts it, right, from a legal accusation to an expression of sorrow or a lamentation. And it's kind of both, right? Yes. And Eric, yes. Eric says, com is a prefix that means thorough or complete. So the transition from complaint to plaint implies, in a sense, an undoing of her complaint in some senses. Yeah, again, it's a pun because in one sense, complaint and plaint are just interchangeable. Like, it's just... complaint is like a modern English translation of the, like, Old French and Middle English plaint, but yes. At the same time, I think that he is doing something with the dropping of the prefix at the same time. And I would come back. Hapuna, to your point about the echoes and the feeling of the echoes, the insubstantiality of it, it also does seem to have, it's literally having an impact on who she is and what she's doing, right? Um, Come, said the eagle. Where? Said I. Come into court. Your case is to be heard. And he called aloud once more. She's come! She's come! Then from every crack and hole in the mountains there came out dark things like men, so that there was a crowd of them all round me before I could fly. They seized on me and hustled me and passed me on from one to another, each shouting towards the mountain face, "Here she comes! Here is the woman!" And voices, as it seemed, from within the mountain answered them, "Bring her in! Bring her into court! Her case is to be heard!" I was dragged and pushed and sometimes lifted up among the rocks, till at last a great black hole yawned before me. "Bring her in! The court waits!" came the voices. And with a sudden shock of cold, I was hurried in out of the burning sunlight into the dark inwards of the mountain, and then further and further in, always in haste, always passed from hand to hand, and always with that din of shouts, "Here she is! She's come at last! To the judge! To the judge!" Then the voices changed and grew quieter, and now it was, "Let her go! Make her stand up! Silence in the court! Silence for her complaint!" Hapuna, this is somewhat like the falling through the pillar room floor with the king. That sense of going deeper and deeper into levels further down, right? We should definitely be remembering that. But let's not forget, there's a reason I did all that recap of the context, right? What just happened? Remember what she was just doing? Remember it? I sat upon the sand, gazing up at them, till I felt as if the flesh would be burned off my bones. Do you remember what she just said right before this slide? She comes to the mountain and sees all the snakes and scorpions. What does she say? Remember what she says? What does she say? What's she supposed to do? She has her empty bowl, or she thinks she has her empty bowl. What's her job? What's her quest? What's her task? She's supposed to get the water. Where's the water? In the mountain. She's got to get up the mountain, which is covered with snakes and scorpions, get into the mountain and go down, down, down to the well where the water of death emerges. And yes, Devora, she says, it's impossible. She had just said, It's not possible. I can't get up there. It cannot be done. Wait a second. What else was impossible that she was not able to do? Recently. 2 weeks ago, maybe. What else was impossible? To drown herself. Well, drowning herself would have been possible. She just wasn't permitted. The god told her not to do it. It could have. I mean, it's not like it would have worked. What was the thing that she tried to do and totally failed and found was impossible unless the gods helped her? Remember the thing? Dying to herself. Yes. Getting through a day without being evil. Making her soul beautiful. Right? Which was philosophically, Socratically speaking, dying to herself. Yes. Okay. So she was, she couldn't do it. Maybe she could have done it, the gods helping her, but the gods didn't help her. And this led her to the whole question of justice and injustice and predestination and beautiful people versus ugly people. Remember all that stuff, right? Then she gets here. And she's standing in the desert under the glaring sun, no shade, no shadow, nowhere to hide, nothing to drink, nothing to sustain her mortal life, her flesh baking off her bones. And she looks up at the mountain and says, it's impossible. What just happened? What just happened? The focus is on her coming into the court, right? Bring her in, bring her into court. Her case is to be heard. Silence in the court. She's come, she's come. And yet, look what just happened. I was dragged and pushed and sometimes lifted up among the rocks, till at last a great black hole yawned before me. She just got hauled up the mountain that she couldn't possibly climb. The mountain which it was her task to climb, but which she did not have the power to climb. Okay, hang on, guys. Wait, forget about the court for a second. Forget it. So this is going to be hard, because I know you guys love to talk amongst yourself about other things, but stay with me. For these next, stay with me, because I need you to just focus with me on these things, because this is, I need your help sorting this stuff out. Forget the court for a second. We'll come back to the court. But I want to make sure we don't overlook what just happened, what the bringing into court was. She absolutely wasn't able to do what she could not do herself. She was hauled up the mountain, which was impossible for her to climb. But more than that. Not only has she, in fact, she was like, great, I can't, now that I have a book instead of a bowl, I can't do my task. And yet, as soon as that happened, she starts doing the task, right? Or at least she starts progressing towards what seemed to be the goal of the task, right? But wait, but what else happened? Till at last a great black hole yawned before me. And with a sudden shock of cold, I was hurried in out of the burning sunlight into the dark inwards of the mountain. That's a little scary, but she's in the shade. Mercy of the gods. Remember? She was, the flesh was being burned off her bones. Oh, mercy of the gods, could that be a cloud? I looked up at the sky and was nearly blinded. The sun was still straight above my head. Yet at last, though the terrible light seemed to bore through my eyeballs into my brain. Can she get any relief from the torment that she is enduring of the unrelenting light frying her, bearing into her brain? So she, yes, she's being hustled into court. Yes, her complaint is being heard. And again, our focus as hers are so much on that that we can lose sight of these two really important things. One, that the gods do seem to be having mercy on her. She is, in fact, being relieved. The act of being brought into court is the act of being saved from the baking torment of the desert. She is receiving the help and relief, the relief that she hoped for, that she wished for, and also the hope that the help that she acknowledged that she needs. She couldn't possibly get up the mountain. In the end, she's carried up the mountain. She's carried up the mountain and into, down the tunnel, into the black hole, which again, in context, the context of the desert and the burning sun is, black hole's a good thing, right? Especially, I mean, again, as she emphasizes, the sudden shock of cold out of the burning sunlight and into the dark inwards of the mountain. Yes, Sharon, as you say, mercy and intervention don't always look like we want them to. Yes. Yes. This is not how she thought this was going to go. Remember her first, oh, darn it, I've got a book instead of a bowl. This is a disaster. And yet, her complaint, to hear her complaint, this is how she is brought. And she is, in fact, helped to do. She's much closer to achieving the task than she was when she thought she was standing there with a bowl, right? Yes. The book and the bowl would be an awesome tavern name. Yes, it would. Okay. So that was one thing. So remember what that implies. It's important as we now shift back to thinking about the courtroom scene. We should also, we need to be remembering that the task, the book and the bowl, the connection between the book and the bowl, and the connection between her task with the bowl in the mountain and the waters of death. She is supposed to go and find the waters of death. That was her task, right? And so far, the parallels are suggesting that her trial itself is not a diversion from that task, but a kind of completion of that task, or at least progress in that task. More. Think about what we were talking about the divine and the mortal. She is assisted. Mercy of the gods. She is assisted and brought into a cool place, a dark place. By whom? It's not the eagle of the gods. The eagle of the gods, the birds which have been associated with Unget and the Unget sun, the god of the mountain, at many points, right, with the priest's mask and everything else and the egg-shaped temple and the he is born hatching of the priest every year, right, all that stuff, right? So is the bird going to swoop down and take her away? Notice what the eagle said. That might have been on the cards. That like almost happens. It looks like that's what's going to happen. The eagle swoops down. The eagle of the gods swoops down. And notice what he says. He says, "Woman, who are you?" She says, "Orawal, queen of Gloam." And he says, "Then it is not you that I was sent to help." So he, in fact, did swoop down here in order to pick up somebody. But it's not her. She's not the one. She's not going to get swooped up. Yeah, that I was sent to help. Exactly, Ms. Manrique. Yeah. But he's not going to help her. It's not going to, the gods aren't going to, the ego of the gods is not going to come down and pick her up and take her away. Well, if it did, she would probably not be going into the dark in the same way, right? We'll come back to who the eagle is there for, right? We'll have to wait on that one. But it's not her. Instead, who helps her? Who helps her? Yes, as several of you were saying, she crowd surfed up the mountain, Maureen. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. A cloud of witnesses, says Hapuna Girl. Absolutely. Yes. What look like shades. So let's look at the description. From every crack and hole in the mountains, there came out dark things like men, so that there was a crowd of them all round me before I could fly. So these dark figures, like people, like mortals, come spilling out, right, of the mountain. From every crack and hole in the mountain. And it is, Devorah was saying, it is almost like the snakes and scorpions transformed into these spirits or something. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they're the dead. They look like people. Like mortals. Not like gods. And they're dark and shadowy. And she is hurried in. She's passed from hand to hand. She does, in fact, crowd surf up the mountain, right? passed from hand to hand with shouts and the voices and everything else, right? So the shades, they look like shades, like Greek shades, almost like Homeric shades. Thinking of the Odyssey. We'll get to that. She'll have that conversation in a little bit. And through the intervention of these shades of the dead, of dead mortals, she is brought out of the glaring sun of the divine gaze, of the divine presence, and into a dark place, a cool, dark place, like the House of Unget. We see mortals here. Again, we're all, the whole thing is like in the divine realm, in the Deadlands, right? But this is like where mortals are, where mortals go, and they pull her in with them. And remember, the contrast here is the eagle. We got the eagle of the gods who swoops down and who could take her up closer to the gods, closer to the sun, right? It's hotter up there. Ask Icarus, right? It's hotter up there if the, you go up with the eagle, right? And instead of the gods reaching down to pull her up, the mortals, the dead mortals, the shades of the mortals reach out and pull her in, pull her down, right? And yet, Devorah, I don't know if we're supposed to be literally understanding that the snakes and scorpions turn into the shades, but that there's some sort of connection between them seems clear. And here I remember, I don't remember who said it. Maureen, I think it might have been you. I don't remember. Last time, remembering, very aptly remembering Psyche's love for ugly things, right? That what looks from a distance horrifying with the snakes and the scorpions, that instead the life with which, or like the, you know, the life might be ironic here, but anyway, the life with which the mountain was squirming and seething, it turns out to be the spirits of mortals that are there instead, right? And that maybe, maybe there is a parallel here. Because all those ugly things like toads that Psyche loved, remember what happened when she loved them? Remember what Orwell said about what happened when Psyche appreciated and loved ugly things? And she, yeah, exactly. She made them beautiful by loving them. Yeah. When she loved them, she could make them beautiful. Maybe we are supposed to think about sort of the mass of mortal souls in this way. Yeah. So I think that connection, that feels like a legit connection there. And now she's been brought in down among them where it's dark and cool. And it's in that context, in a much more House of Unget-like place. That is the place. Remember, the House of Unget is the place where the mortal and the divine can come into contact, in a place where it's dark and safe. Yeah, Ms. Manrique says, maybe they're all born ugly. I'm so glad you remembered that. Yes, because I wasn't even thinking that, but that's the last step, isn't it? Snakes and scorpions and ugly, unchancy things, but if you love them, they can be made beautiful, right? And Orwell's thought about being born physically ugly and having an ugly body and having an ugly soul, and no one will love, all ugly women know that men will not love you unless you're beautiful, right? Except maybe someone could love something that is unchancy and ugly. And maybe if that did happen, the ugly would be made beautiful, which it was not able in her experience. Neither of her physical body nor of her soul was she able to make herself beautiful. Right. Yes. And Emily, I agree. It's not a very flattering view of men either. In fact, Emily, it is, of course, the very rejection, the statement that no man will love you unless you have a pretty face is very much an indictment of the soul of the men in question. Right. And I would add, by the way, one of the few contrary examples we get of this is Bardia's faithful love for his wife, whom you'll remember is no longer really very beautiful anymore, right? She was very beautiful, but remember when Orwell first meets her, she expects this great beauty, but she doesn't find a great beauty. She finds his advanced middle-aged wife who's borne him 8 children, right? And yet Bardia's love for her did not change, no matter how her appearances changed, right? Yeah, that was her beauty. Ansett was someone who was loved. And made beautiful, right? Yeah, anyway, okay. So many connections, right? So good. Let's get back. So back into the dark inwards of the mountain. And Hapuna, I think it was you who was talking about, who is remembering the pillar room under the pillar room under the pillar room, right? There is also that sense here of going sort of deeper down. I said that it's dark in here, like it's dark in the House of Unget. But it is almost like this is deeper down, right? I wonder if that, I'm not sure that parallel works, but maybe it does. If like the pillar room under the pillar, if this is to the House of Unget, almost in a sense, what the lower pillar rooms were to the upper pillar rooms. Anyway, all right, let's keep going. Back to the trial. I was now free from all their hands, alone, as I thought, in silent darkness. Then a sort of gray light came. I stood on a platform or pillar of rock in a cave so great that I could see neither the sides nor the roof of it. All round me, below me, up to the very edges of the stone I stood on, there surged a sort of unquiet darkness. But soon my eyes grew able to see things in that half-light. The darkness was alive. It was a great assembly, all staring upon me, and I uplifted on my perch above their heads. Never in peace or war have I seen so vast a concourse. There were tens of thousands of them, all silent, every face watching me. Among them I saw Bata, and the king my father, and the fox, and Argon. They were all ghosts. In my foolishness, I had not thought before how many dead there must be. The faces, one above the other, for the place was shaped that way, rose and receded in the grayness till the very thought of counting, not the faces, that would be madness, but the mere ranks of them, was tormenting. The endless place was packed full as it could hold. The court had met. Ooh, Jackrabbit, I love that. This darkness is the darkness that the House of Unget is trying to represent. Yeah, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. So, Eric, you're right that the House of Unget was in the valley, and this is beneath the mountain, which is Psyche's palace. Yes, but also, notice that this is like a valley. It's like a bowl, right? And she's in the middle of the pillar there. Morgul Hamster, she's surrounded by faces. right? Surrounded by faces. And yeah, light here. There's light here, but no mention of a light source. Yes, yes. Holy places are dark places. But now notice that notice the gradual growth of the light. She was in darkness, and then a sort of gray light came, and she could see where she was. And then she sees the darkness seem to be alive, and then she sees the ascent, like she begins to see out, and then she can see like all the way up, like there's like stadium seating here. She's on a pillar in the middle, and there are people all around on the floor, but then the sides all sweep up, and there's, it's just so many people, right? And yeah, Mighty Felix, it's very unclear. Is the light increasing, or is her ability to see increasing? Darkness and the slow growth of light contrasted with the unvarying, baking, glaring, torturing sunlight outside, right? Instead, now she's in darkness, surrounded by mortals, the ghosts, the shades of mortals. She's in a very, on the one hand, a very mortal place, but also, it's a mortal place in the deadlands, in the places of the gods. Except at the bottom instead of the top, not up at the top of the mountain, right? But again, it seems that I think it very likely that her own vision is improving. And I can't help but remember Psyche saying to Orawal, maybe he will make it so that you can see it over time. The palace, right? Which she couldn't see. Just as it seems likely that eventually Psyche would be able to see her husband, right? But that he had good reason not to do that to her right away. And that Orawal would also undergo a process. And I think there is something of a process. And again, it's this process instead of in mercy, right? Relieving her from the torturous sunlight in which she could see everything and only wished she could hide in darkness. Exactly. They were just shades and now they're people with faces. Yes, exactly. Her perception of the people around her changes as well. Yes, like her vision is improving. Yes. I too am interested in the fact that Bardia, she doesn't see Bardia. I think that is a mercy too, because remember, yeah, he would be a distraction. She is at peace with the Bardia thing, but it still seems that seeing Bardia would have a particular kind of freight to it that seeing Bata and the King and the Fox and Argon doesn't go there, right? The court had met. But on the same level with me, though far away, sat the judge. Male or female, who could say? Its face was veiled. It was covered from crown to toe in sweepy black. Who should we be thinking of? Its face was veiled? Orawal, yeah. The queen herself, who was the judge. This was her job, right? the Veiled Queen, whose wisdom is so great, whose power is like that of the gods, who has this mythic, divine aspect for all the people of Gloam as she sits on her seat of judgment, right? And yes, who was the task that she was, you know, who was in charge of the task? Like, who was she doing the task for? For Unget, right? Is Unget her judge? I'm not saying I necessarily think that Unget is her judge necessarily. But she was the judge, and she is Unget. And Unget, she is the prisoner or the slave of Unget and is trying to be set free, right? In this third trial. And anyway, there it is. A male or female, who could say, veiled-faced judge, covered from crown to toe. Crown means the top of her head, but come on now. In sweepy black. "Uncover her," said the judge. Hands came from behind me and tore off my veil. After it, every rag I had on. The old crone with her Unget face stood naked before those countless gazers. No thread to cover me, no bowl in my hand to hold the water of death, only my book. Another unveiling, and this is a big unveiling, Jackie, right? We saw her unveiled before her father in the vision in which they dug down into pillar room after pillar room, right? She unveiled herself to go out into the streets of the city. She unveiled herself in order to conceal herself, right, when she went down to commit suicide. She unveiled herself before Ansett. Yes. Now she is completely unveiled. Every rag I had on. Her whole body, her whole self, standing naked before the judge and before the countless gazers. No thread to cover me, no bowl in my hand to hold the water of death, only my book. She's still thinking about her task. So notice again, this standing in the dock, right, on the pillar. Oh, it's a pillar. So this room, this big room in which there's a pillar. Okay. Anyway, standing on the pillar in the room, and she's still thinking in terms of the task. The task is not gone, right? She's not just changed out of that dream into another dream. It's the same dream that's still going on. And she still feels herself to be in a bad situation. She has no bowl to hold the water of death. How could she get the waters of death? It's impossible. It's impossible for her to get the waters of death. She doesn't even have a bowl. She just has her book. Yes, she's in a pillar room still. Yes. Yes. "Read your complaint," said the judge. I looked at the roll in my hand and saw at once that it was not the book I had written. It couldn't be. It was far too small and too old. A little shabby, crumpled thing. Not like my great book that I had worked on all day, day after day, while Bardia was dying. I thought I would fling it down and trample on it. I'd tell them someone had stolen my complaint and slipped this thing into my hand instead. Yet I found myself unrolling it. It was written all over inside, but the hand was not like mine. It was all a vile scribble, each stroke mean and yet savage, like the snarl in my father's voice, like the ruinous faces one could make out in the Unget stone. A great terror and loathing came over me. I said to myself, whatever they do to me, I will never read out this stuff. Give me back my book. But already I heard myself reading it. Now notice the cues that we get here already. Before we hear her, we know what's coming. Right? We know what's coming. She has been stripped. She has been unveiled. The naked ugliness of her body and of her soul, it's like a snarl. The very appearance of her book is not what she thought. She thinks of her book, my great book. This is just a little shabby, crumpled thing. Not the great book that I wrote. The hand wasn't at all like hers. She writes an excellent hand. This was a vile scribble. Mean and yet savage. Like the snarl in my father's voice. Like the ruinous faces one could make out in the ungate stone. Oh, those similes cut really deep. Yeah, that is a little bit what your book is like, right? What do both of those things speak to? Ugliness of soul, right? The snarl in her father's voice, one of the ugliest, most dehumanizing things she knew as a child, right? And yet, she speaks in that voice. We just heard her say that to Ansett. Right. Psyche told her how much she looked like their father when she was angry, and snarls like him as well. And yes, the hideous, amorphous, sickening, blood-caked faces on the side of the indeterminate ungate stone. And remember, that's the face she saw in the mirror when she confronted the mirror at the bottom in the lowest pillar room, right? Oh, that's interesting. Eric says, the ruinous face represents her own debasement. The snarl of her father represents how she debases others. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Remember that she already saw. She already spoke of seeing at the beginning, while she was writing the book, and when she had finished writing the book. By the time she finished writing the book, she had made her complaint against the gods. But as she explained at the beginning of the first chapter of Book 2, that very action itself began to provide her an answer. As she discovered truths about the past that she had forgotten, that she had pushed away, that she had bricked up with thick walls of stone, like the well with its creaking chains in the yard, like Orawal in her womb, bricked up to die. She spoke of seeing these truths, confronting these truths about herself that were like being operated on, like her body being opened up and the ugly, not to mention painful, insides of her being exposed, right, by the surgeons. And yet it seems clear in this vision that she, there is much that she still didn't recognize. She still thinks of it as a great work, as a beautiful and elaborate and substantial book, right? Yeah, Hepuna, I think this is the final stage of the surgery. Yeah, Yeah. This is the completion of that process that she already pointed to. She already prepared us for, right? And then she reads her real book. Yeah, and Emily, I think you're exactly right. The book started out as an accusation of the gods and turns into an indictment document of her own crimes. Yeah, yeah. That's how she comes to feel about it. And that's what it seems like she's seeing before she even opens it, right? And what I read out was like this. I know what you'll say. You will say the real gods are not at all like Unget, and that I was shown a real god and the house of a real god and ought to know it. Hypocrites, I do know it, as if that would heal my wounds. I could have endured it if you were things like Unget and the Shadow Brute. You know well that I never really began to hate you until Psyche began talking of her palace and her lover and her husband. Why did you lie to me? You said a brute would devour her. Well, why didn't it? I'd have wept for her and buried what was left and built her a tomb and... But to steal her love from me? Can it be that you really don't understand? Do you think we mortals find you gods easier to bear if you're beautiful? I tell you that if that's true, we'll find you 1,000 times worse. For then, I know what beauty does. You'll lure and entice. You'll leave us nothing. Nothing that's worth our keeping or your taking. Those we love best, whoever's most worth loving, those are the very ones you'll pick out. Oh, I can see it happening age after age, and growing worse and worse the more you reveal your beauty. The son turning his back on the mother, and the bride on her groom, stolen away by this everlasting calling, calling, calling of the gods. Taken where we can't follow. It would be far better for us if you were foul and ravening. We'd rather you drank their blood than stole their hearts. We'd rather they were ours and dead than yours and made immortal. But to steal her love from me, to make her see things I couldn't see? Oh, you'll say you've been whispering it to me these 40 years, that I'd signs enough her palace was real, could have known the truth if I'd wanted. But how could I want to know it? Tell me that. The girl was mine. What right had you to steal her away into your dreadful heights? You'll say I was jealous. Jealous of Psyche? Not while she was mine. If you'd gone the other way to work, if it was my eyes you had opened, you'd soon have seen how I would have shown her and told her and taught her and led her up to my level. But to hear a chit of a girl who had or ought to have had no thought in her head that I'd not put there, setting up for a seer and a prophetess and next thing to a goddess, how could anyone endure it? That's why I say it makes no difference whether you're fair or foul. That there should be gods at all. There's our misery and bitter wrong. There's no room for you and us in the same world. You're a tree in whose shadow we can't thrive. We want to be our own. I was my own, and Psyche was mine, and no one else had any right to her. Oh, you'll say you took her away into bliss and joy, such as I never could have given her, and I ought to have been glad of it for her sake. Why? What should I care for some horrible new happiness which I hadn't given her and which separated her from me? Do you think I wanted her to be happy that way? It would have been better if I'd seen the brute tear her in pieces before my eyes. You stole her to make her happy, did you? Why, every wheedling, smiling, catfoot rogue who lures away another man's wife or slave or dog might say the same. Dog now, that's very much to the purpose. I'll thank you to let me feed my own. It needed no titbits from your table. Did you ever remember whose the girl was? She was mine. Mine. Do you not know what the word means? Mine. You're thieves, seducers. That's my wrong. I'll not complain, not now that you're blood drinkers and man-eaters. I'm past that. Enough, said the judge. Whew. Okay. Yes. Yes, good. JJ is remembering the quote about what she experienced when she sees the god. He made it to be as if from the beginning I had known that Psyche's lover was a god, and as if all my doubtings, fears, guessings, debatings, questionings of Bardia, questionings of the fox, all the rummage and business of it, had been trumped up foolery, dust blown in my own eyes by myself. This is when she's accusing the gods of changing the past, right? And JJ says they didn't alter the past, But they did alter her book to match the truth of the past. Yes. Yes. Yeah, exactly, Carrie. I had to read that in one single breath. There's no way I could interrupt in the middle of those slides. And this is really hard. It's going to be hard to kind of sort through. But let's see if we can just kind of follow the major points. To some extent, I don't feel like nearly as much commentary is needed here, because clearly here we see her saying the things which, you know, many of which, most of which we were seeing from the beginning. The truths that she wasn't admitting to herself, the possessiveness of her love, her jealousy of Psyche, and jealousy on a couple different levels. We can see her jealousy in the sense of possessiveness. She not wanting to share. She's mine, mine. That's jealousy speaking, right? But also envy of Psyche as well. Envy that this little chit of a girl should be elevated above her, right? Yes, yes. The possessive love is the thing we've been accusing of her of all along. And she now is clear. And yeah, Kalairos, I agree. We can't exactly go down and break down her argument, because she's not making an argument. It really is very much selfish rambling, right? You're right, Jackie. Chit of a girl is a phrase that Lewis uses several times in his writing. I've always gotten the impression that that was a thing people said, like a particular kind of insult against girls, you know, in the first half of the 20th century. It's a good, bad one. Yes, I agree. I agree. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, good. Leaf of Starlight says, I find the on its face unhinged and unreasonable aspect of it to be very convincing. So often our internal monologues can get like this, but we don't see it. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Her complaint against the gods. What? So let's think about this. Two things that I want to make sure we do draw out of this. What do we learn from her real book, right? What do we learn from her complaint about Orawal's attitude to the gods and relationship with the gods? Like, what does she actually say? What does she actually accuse the gods of? And secondly, what do we see about her relationship with Psyche? But let's start with that, because we already kind of did. The possessiveness. Right. Her love of Psyche was always love of herself. It was always about herself. That's the element that she continually reveals, that she was betraying. She was betraying all through book one. Right. You said a brute would devour her. Well, why didn't it? I'd have wept for her and buried what was left and built her a tomb, but to steal her love from me? Do you think we mortals will find you gods easier to bear if you're beautiful? Yeah. She's the real shadow brute. Yes, the loving and the devouring are one. That is certainly true in one horrible sense with Orawal, as she desired to devour Psyche, right? Think back now to all of those passages in the beginning of book one, like chapter three, which talking about Psyche and Psyche's beauty and how wonderful Psyche is and how Psyche makes everything better, right? Think how that looks now in the context of this, right? How much in awe she seemed to be of Psyche, how much she seemed to love and appreciate her. And now, now she, when we look back at that through the lens of this complaint, we can see it was always all about her, how it made her feel, how it, what it gave to her, what it filled in her, not what she was giving to Psyche. She didn't want Psyche to be happy, not if it meant her Orwell losing Psyche, right? You'll say that I'd signs enough that her palace was real. I could have known it was the truth if I'd wanted. How could I want to know it? The girl was mine. It is her possessiveness of Psyche that made it impossible for her, because that made it impossible for her to accept the gods and the messages of the gods. Because in order for her to accept the gods, in order for her to accept even the potential beauty and glory, the happiness of Psyche, the bliss of Psyche, the apotheosis of Psyche, right? And the invitation for her to join in that, right? In order for her to accept that, she would first have had to give up Psyche herself. And notice even like at the end when she's talking about the gods merely being thieves, right? Yeah, Maureen, to be beautiful is to lure and entice. Yes. Yes. Remember her envy of beautiful women, right? As well. Anyway, her characterization of the gods being thieves and stealing Psyche away. That's what it boiled down to. Like, it, you stole her to make her happy, did you? I don't care. Right. Now, but back to the first thing. What do we learn here? What does she reveal? Literally before God and everyone, about her complaint against the gods. What she complains about with them. Is her real complaint that they are malevolent? No. I could have endured it if you were things like Unget and the Shadow Brute. If you were that ugly, hideous thing that she felt such scorn for. She could have endured that. Why did you lie to me? Do you think we would find it easier to bear if you're beautiful? And yes, Jocelyn, you are absolutely right that... Yes. Can one be a giving and loving person if one has never had that modeled? Yeah, no, I agree. And as just as Hapuna was saying in response, Orwell has had a raw deal. She needed an Ancet early in her life to model healthy emotionality for her. Yes, exactly. She's always been an ugly woman, envious of beauty, aware of the fact, getting a raw deal and knowing that she's getting a raw deal, having no hope that things will ever go her way. Yeah, That's been her whole experience. It's been her whole experience. What is her primary complaint against the gods? That they're competition. They're the ultimate competition. They're the ultimate beautiful girl. They're the ultimate ansit to which you're always going to lose your Bardia to, right? Bardia is always going to marry them instead of loving you. He's not even going to look at you as if you're a woman, like he never looked in at Orwell that way, right? And Bardia's choosing Ansett over her is but the smallest shadow of what the competition that the gods will always be. You'll lure and entice. You'll leave us nothing. You'll take those we love best. So, one of the naked realities that is revealed here, and Jocelyn, I think this is very much connected to what you were talking about. It's very much connected to the fact that Orwell wasn't loved. Though, footnote, remember how fortunate Orwell was in her counselors. She is a very well-loved queen to whom people have been showing phenomenal devotion throughout her life. Right? Not saying you're wrong, but remember there's always that other side to it as well, even though she doesn't always see it or appreciate it, just as was revealed in the conversation with Ansett, right? But it's important for us to hold on to that irony. On the one hand, Orwell is a deeply unloved person with very little experience of love and much experience of condemnation and loneliness. On the other hand, simultaneously, Orwell has also been loved throughout her life. And people have devoted their lives to her in ways that few people ever devote their lives to anyone. So both are true, right? And both, I think, are important here. But back to what we can see here. What do we learn about what is the heart of Orwell's... what is the heart of Orwell's worldview here, right? She speaks of... Essentially, she characterizes two kind of sources of happiness... Two sources of fulfillment. There's relationships with others, like her relationship with Psyche, first and foremost, right? Psyche was mine. Why is she possessive? Yes, she's possessive. Obsessively so. Why? Why is she so possessive? Why is she clinging to this thing? Because that's all she knows. The deeper irony of her complaint is she is acknowledging all the way through, yes, you gods are beautiful and you entice and you lure and you hold out these gifts to mortals. But notice what she never allows for. She never allows for her accepting that. Think of the irony of the statement. How could I want to know it? I could have known the truth if I'd wanted. How could I want to know it? In order for her to choose to know, choose to acknowledge, choose to hear those messages that we heard the gods giving to her all the way through, right? We were joking about that for months. How could she want? Well, she could want to know if she were willing to accept that. If she were willing to accept the happiness, the beauty that was being extended to her. But why couldn't she want that? Because instead she was clinging. The girl was mine. Right? That was the only basis on which she was willing to be made happy. If she would be given Psyche, she would only accept happiness. She would only accept blessedness on her own terms. And her terms were terms which were absolutely at Psyche's expense. Her terms were ones, it is revealed in her complaint here, in which Psyche herself is made the merest instrument of Orawal's own happiness. The girl was mine. What right had you to steal her away into your dreadful heights? She doesn't even acknowledge that she herself was invited to those same heights. Why should your heart not dance, Orawal? Remember that? Why should your heart not dance? But she had an answer to that question. And she still has an answer to that question. Why her heart shouldn't dance. Because she won't let it. Yeah. We can see this sort of trap that Orawal is stuck in. The prison that she is trapped in. Like the prison in the womb of the queen, where Orawal was bricked up to shrink and die. As the queen was trying to kill Orawal. Right? Enough, said the judge. There was utter silence all round me, and now for the first time I knew what I had been doing. While I was reading, it had, once and again, seemed strange to me that the reading took so long, for the book was a small one. Now I knew that I had been reading it over and over, perhaps a dozen times. I would have read it forever, quick as I could, starting the first word again almost before the last was out of my mouth, if the judge had not stopped me. And the voice I read it in was strange to my ears. There was given to me a certainty that this, at last, was my real voice. There was silence in the dark assembly, long enough for me to have read my book out yet again. At last the judge spoke. "Are you answered?" he said. "Yes," said I. The gods have no answer to her complaint, because the complaint is the answer. The complaint was the answer. To have heard myself making it was to be answered. Lightly men talk of saying what they mean. Often when he was teaching me to write in Greek, the fox would say, "Child, to say the very thing you really mean, the whole of it, nothing more or less or other than what you really mean, that is the whole art and joy of words." A glib saying. When the time comes to you, at which you will be forced, at last, to utter the speech which has lain at the center of your soul for years, which you have all that time, idiot-like, been saying over and over, you'll not talk about joy of words. I saw well why the gods do not speak to us openly, nor let us answer. Till that word can be dug out of us, why should they hear the babble that we think we mean? How can they meet us face to face till we have faces? Well, that's all for this week, folks. That's the mic drop moment right there. The title of the book is the second half of this rhetorical question, which is the answer to her complaint, to her accusations against the gods. Yes. And the phrase, "till we have faces," parallels "till that word is dug out of us." I pushed ahead and read these last two slides because I wanted to get there for completion's sake. There's a lot more to dig. We don't have to, it's late. We don't have time to dig in. We'll start with these two again next time. And then we'll get into the post-trial phase. What happens to her? Let's not forget, she still has her task. She still has to get the waters of death, to collect the waters of death in her bowl. And her bowl is her book, right? Yeah, Cal Elros, I agree. Till that word can be dug out of us, it is back to the surgery metaphor. Till the word, the thing that we really mean to say, is dug out of us like a tumor. Yeah. Yeah. Just like that. Yes. Yes. And the pillar room under the pillar room, 100%. We'll come back to all these connections. We'll start with this stuff next time. I was thinking the same thing, Mighty Felix, which is why I put the title "The Mirror" on this particular slide, because I was thinking about that. So this is the beginning of chapter 4. Good news is we're in the final chapter of this book. Bad news is it's not bad news. The other news is that there's still a lot to discuss. Next time, perhaps, we will get so far as revisiting her three tribulations and seeing what else was happening at the same time. All right. So, thanks everybody. Again, we'll come back. Don't worry. We're going to come back to this slide, both of these these last two slides. And, we'll continue on through chapter 4 of book 2 here. Thanks everybody. Look forward, as always, to our discussion again next week. And in the meantime, have a good week. See you guys next week. Bye now.